The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100, and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Donnelly view system deal. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
With Vanguard Advice, no matter what your retirement goals are, they can help you get there and enjoy it for years to come. The financial journey is all yours, but you never have to take it alone. That's the value of ownership. Visit Vanguard.com and explore Vanguard Advice. All investing is subject to risk. Fund shareholders own the funds that own Vanguard. Services are provided by Vanguard Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor.
Hello, Toffees, and welcome back to the Blue Room's premier offering, which is, of course, the Kickabout. I am ready for the scathing criticism from the other Blue Room members for that opening, but we are, of course, here to talk about why Everton are great again, Twitch is still shit, and we all collectively count our winnings from the most obvious nap in Premier League history, which was Adam Armstrong scoring the opening goal after exactly 20 minutes in the opener at Goodison Park. Of course, things turned up well from there, but I am, as ever, joined by Rob Vera to chat about that game, to talk about an actual game of football, which will be interesting. And we've got the Power Wash Prince, Adam Sutton, here with us as well. Adam, you're about to have your tea, and before we go any further, what are you having, mate?
I'm having a... can't remember the exact name of it. I think it's like Quick Cook Chicken Biryani from Gusto. I don't know if anyone's using... Do you know what? It was Karcher last week, but this week, the plug for the next sponsor of the Kickabout will be Gusto. So use my link below and you can get 25% off your first box.
You are not a jet-washing influencer. I am not having this. We really haven't heard from Karcher since the last show, but you never know, mate. It might pick up this week.
Yeah, so I'm a massive fan of Gusto, to be fair. HelloFresh, all that lark. It's turned me from literally one of the most boring chefs, I'm never going to use the word chefs, into someone who can actually like cook something that isn't chicken and rice on a daily basis. So it's not me cooking it today, but yeah, it's a curry. Hopefully I'm not like dribbling down the mic or something in the next 10 minutes.
Well, my latest food-based investment is the Mowgli cookbook. So Rob Mowgli is an Indian street food restaurant in Liverpool, which when you are eventually back over in the UK, we'll be able to take you to and try out. And whilst we're on the topic, Rob, breaking news, you will be back over here with us in December for two disappointing Everton defeats against Brighton and Newcastle, I think, are the two games that you're here for. First and foremost, mate, are you excited to have a trip back over here planned?
Yeah, I have dumped this nasty girlfriend called Everton so many times, and yet here I am crawling my lame ass back to her open arms. It wasn't just the game on Saturday or anything like that. I obviously, kind of like everyone, not being in the stadium for a long period of time, it's just been kind of an 18-month bummer for everyone. But I'm someone who really had gotten into a rhythm of starting to come out to Liverpool and wanted to come out annually. And obviously not being able to do that, I've had the itch. And I don't know, maybe I caught a little bit of the fever on Saturday and decided to just say, fuck it and book a flight. It's at a time of year I'm coming after Christmas time, so It's when I'm not really working and there's and my wife is ready to certainly have a break from me for a few days post Christmas holidays with all the family. And it just felt like the right time and a chance to catch at least potentially, hopefully, the Premier League scheduling gods or whatever they're called are look on me favorably and don't mess with those games. But normally in the festive period, they're always going to be an obscene number of games. And in fact, I believe I think we play Burnley away on the 26th.
Yeah.
I literally arrive I land, if all things go according to plan, I land at the Manchester airport at 6:30 in the morning on match day. So I am going to go straight from the airport to take a long nap or something, or maybe I need to try and stay awake. It's always there's always that struggle of deciding how you handle it, but it will be a fever dream, that Newcastle match on the 28th, that I will barely be kind of semi awake for, but I can't wait. But the opportunity to get to see two matches at Goodison on a single trip, which I've never been able to do before, is something I'm pretty excited about. In addition to spending New Year's on Merseyside with my friends, and I can't wait. It's going to be great. I'm sure we'll do plenty of live Blue Room / kickabout content that involves us being together and drinking, because what other reason would we get together? So yeah.
as you know, what else could we possibly wish to do over here? I think from a scheduling point of view, I like to think that you'll be fortunate. Obviously there's a lot of tradition about the spacing of games over here, so Boxing Day and New Year's Day are usually quite fixed. We try and cram in some form of meaningless game that no one cares about in the middle, which will obviously be the Brighton game.
It'll be the Newcastle game. The Brighton game is on New Year's Day. It's the Newcastle game on the 28th. But
yeah, that would be a good opportunity at that time of year to goad Newcastle for bringing 45 fans to Goodison and then claiming to be the biggest club in Britain. It'll be great to, as you say, Rob, to cram a couple of games in. I only said this before the game at the weekend, in that before that game at Goodison Park on Saturday, there was, all being well, the stadium opening on time for the 24-25 season, and obviously on the assumption that Everton never play a cup game at Goodison Park ever again, which is quite likely given the impending defeat to Huddersfield on Tuesday night. But yet we are potentially just over 50 games away from leaving Goodison Park, which I think we probably all feel this, Adam, a little bit more, primarily on the back of the last 18 months. I think we wouldn't necessarily have this internal ticking down of the clock if it wasn't for the fact that we all kind of, in some correct way or not, feel cheated by not being able to go and watch Everton. And I think what we saw on Saturday and what we'll feel in the next few seasons of Goodison Park is probably going to remind us of all of the things that we hope to transition into Bramley Moor. And I know that we've had these conversations in the last few months about potentially leaving Goodison, and obviously with work progressing at Bramley Moor, that feeling becomes closer and closer. But I think when you are given a taster of what Goodison Park is meant to be like we were given on Saturday, it's getting to that point now where you almost start flipping that on its head and thinking about how much you'll miss it as opposed to how much you appreciate it being here now.
Yeah, I think it's always going to be a real worry about whether we can transfer that atmosphere over from Goodison Park to Bramley Moor Dock, and I don't think it ever will, in the sense of there's so many players down the years, both Everton players and opposition players really, who have talked about this atmosphere and how close we are to the pitch, and the fans can basically grab you as you're running past. And that is something that you can never really have at a new stadium. And you look at ones that have gone very well and ones that have gone very badly. I think West Ham's ground has always come under criticism for how they have articulated that atmosphere almost. But then you look at that, huge stand at Tottenham's ground on the weekend, and it looks absolutely incredible. So, yeah, they've got to get it right in terms of how you can display and how you can really give it that cauldron feel and that baptism of fire for when you do grab, I don't know, a 75th minute winner, or you do go 1-0 up early doors against Liverpool or United or a big team, that just then it's just no going back. And you get those games every so often, and I look back at United 4-0 under Marco Silva, and it's just as soon as that first goal goes in, they've just got no chance. And we need to make sure that we've got a ground that is, I know it's the old cliche of a fortress, but that's what it is, and that's what it needs to be, because it can look as good as it wants, and it can hold as many fans, or it can have this hospitality or these surrounding areas with loads of bars and pubs. But if people aren't intimidated when they step into that ground, both as a player and an away fan, then you're going to become quite a soft touch, really. And I think that's what West Ham were. I know they're turning that around in regards to the football, and they obviously come hand in hand. But yeah, it's going to be a really strange. It hasn't really sunk in for me yet, because I think it probably is that last 18 months we've kind of got used to not being in the ground. So therefore, that you're not really thinking about being in any ground, never mind a new one. But I think it's in that, I don't know, next couple of seasons when it really does start to get to, I don't know, 30 games and 20 games, it's going to become a real strange feeling and a real apprehensive feeling. Do we really want this to happen? It's like, you know, when you move down to uni or something, or you move out for the first time and it's a couple of days in, you go, what have I done here? Is this right? Is this what I want? Is this just because everyone else is doing it that I'm doing it? But we shall see how that...
I've got to say, even about three or four seasons out now, I have a resting level of anxiety about how our form is going into the last four or five home games. I think so often in this situation, you see, I think Tottenham beat Man United at the last game at White Hart Lane. West Ham beat Man United 3-2 in the last game at Upton Park. And it always feels as though there's a romantic element to a team finishing off in their own stadium. And if show me a team that gets their arse handed to them more than we would in the last game at Goodison Park against a newly promoted Colchester side. I mean, it would absolutely happen. Rob, before we started recording, we were talking about the games that you've managed to be over here for in the past. You've seen some things, mate. You've seen Cenk Tosun score a goal at Goodison Park.
Very nice goal, actually, yeah.
You've seen Gbamon play in the middle of an Everton midfield, which I don't think many people could say. And you've also seen Everton play down at Bournemouth, which is a notoriously difficult away game to get to. This isn't the game that you got to, but I'll tell you my worst memory of Everton going to Bournemouth. And it was that 3-3 game in which Ross Barkley looked to have clinched the game late on for us. And I was actually out with friends at the Christmas markets in Manchester, which hopefully we'll get to when you're over. But obviously, at the point where Ross Barkley puts Everton 3-2 up, I march over to the bar like a big man and decide to buy an enormous celebratory round for about 8 or 9 people that have come to the market with us. And I am not joking you. Mid handing over of cash to the barman, someone taps me on the shoulder and lets me know that Everton have conceded a 145th minute equaliser.
Junior Stanislas, right? It was always him, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually. Yeah. So that was probably my darkest moment of following Everton away, and I actually wasn't there. But Rob, just being back at Goodison Park, I think so much has been focused around how being back at Goodison impacted the fans. How did the fans feel? Mm-hmm. And as much as we'll go on to talk about that in this show and in future shows, it was quite interesting to focus on the players who we've all decided over the last 18 months are in some way, be it positively or negatively, influenced by having the fans there. We're going to talk about one of each, but I think the main positive we'd all agree, particularly on the back of the last 2 or 3 months and how busy it's been for him, was Richarlison. He is someone who clearly thrives off an energy. He thrives off an intensity, which is something that we mentioned in post-match about a word that Rafael Benitez has kind of coined with the Everton fans and obviously tried to utilise that to our advantage on Saturday. But is that what you probably expect from Richarlison, just being the nature of the character and the player he is? Or were you even surprised by how much he was able to offer given his busy summer?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because I do feel that given the performance, which to me, he was my man of the match, but he and Decore, either way, I mean, you can't go wrong. They're both fantastic. I do think we're at risk of kind of oversimplifying and saying, oh, look how good Richarlison looked. Clearly, it was the fans being back that was the reason. What I do believe is that there were a lot of factors. I think he's more sharp and match fit than anyone just because he's been playing nonstop. B, he's been playing really well all summer. I think that's really the biggest factor in all of this. He played well on Saturday because he's been playing well for a couple of months now. And I would also note he's been doing that in empty stadiums, both at Copa America and the Olympics. So, and granted, I know playing for your country sometimes it's a little bit different, but what I do believe very much is that the fans were certainly, especially because of the context and the fact that it was the second half and we're a goal down, I do think that the fans certainly made a difference for Richarlison and for the team in general. But what I think in the long term is going to be more critical is to sustain Richarlison, you know, because when you're in a tournament, I think that you've kind of got that sense of, all right, we have a handful of games to accomplish this goal of winning it, or, you know, winning a trophy. And in Richarlison's case, he makes it to the finals in Copa America. And then he obviously wins the gold medal at the Olympics. And so your goal is right there in front of you. The Premier League season is obviously this much longer slog of a thing, right? And I think that's where the fans being back at Goodison and just really fans being in the stadiums in general are going to really help a player like Richarlison continue to stay engaged, to stay as connected as possible. I think I really have never had an issue with Richarlison's effort over the years, even last season. I think people equate his frustration with somehow a lack of effort, which I think that's a weird conflation. I think he just wasn't playing well. I think he was not executing well last season. He had a dip in form. I think that over a long season, not playing in front of fans affects everyone. But I think for a player who thrives on the emotional spectacle that is this type of sport and this type of environment or arena, whatever you want to call it, I think the fans are crucial. And as we saw on Saturday, when you're talking about club football especially, I think for a lot of us, and I said this on the post-match, for those of us who were watching it on television, I think it was kind of a shock to our system to see that and to be reminded again of what that could be, even on television, and how different it sounded and looked and felt. It made last season feel almost like this thing that didn't even really happen. Like, I mean, it did happen, but it feels very empty in hindsight now compared to that. And so when people say that there is no football without fans, that's what they mean. And I think that for players like Richarlison, the fans are a big part of what drives him and sustains him, through, a long period of time. And let's be honest, with the way the squad is looking now, in terms of what we have and haven't done in the window, and really just kind of the sense that this team is going to have to be greater than the sum of its parts, you're going to need everyone, including the crowd, as much as that sounds cliche, pulling together, because it's going to be these sorts of greater than the sum of their parts performances by this team as a collective that will, eke out points when you ordinarily wouldn't have expected it. And you hope that that makes a difference at home this season. Of course, conversely, what does that mean on the road where we had all that success last season? I don't know the answer to that yet, but Richarlison is our best player. And when I say that, I mean, he is our most gifted, most talented player. He is the heartbeat of this thing. We cannot succeed, and we certainly cannot sustain success without Richarlison being at his best. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take everyone, and the crowd and the fans are a huge part of that.
Adam, I think one of the things that we've bemoaned Richarlison for in the past, and probably rightly bigged him up for in the last few days, was surrounding his maturity. And I think he's admittedly one of those players who doesn't necessarily respond well to a great deal of adversity, I would say. And I don't necessarily mean being shrugged off a player, because we know he likes a physical battle and he is a fighter in that sense. But as Rob said last year, when the form wasn't there and when the referees weren't necessarily on his side, you could very quickly see the drop of the shoulders, and you know, the body language police were out as soon as that did happen. But I think what we saw on Saturday in a brief moment, and ultimately it wasn't a very important moment in the grand context of the game, but when he goes down in the penalty area in the first half and is booked for simulation quite early doors, I don't think it's too out there to think that last season he potentially goes missing for the entirety of the game that follows that. And I think the reason that we don't see that, yes, it's one of those things that will come with age and with experience, but I think what Everton and Rafael Benitez have very cleverly done this summer, albeit backed into a corner where they quite simply had to do it to keep him, but they have offered him the chance to take on responsibility. They've said, go and do your Copa America, go and win the Olympics, and you know what, we'll welcome you back with open arms, which we've seen at Finch Farm this week. But I think to then go and say to him, we expect you to be a major focal point of this side in the season going forward, on the back of those tournaments, we don't care if you're tired, we don't necessarily want you to have a rest, and quite frankly, if you look at our squad, we can't afford for you to have a rest. Go and do these things, but you need to be the main man at Everton when you come back. And I think he probably is a player who responds well to that element of internal pressure from the club, not necessarily from outside, but I'm sure there will have been a very frank discussion between Rafael Benitez and Richarlison leading up not only to the season in general, but to that game on Saturday.
I think it comes with him wanting to probably better himself in the future, whether that is with Everton or with another side or internationally. And
yeah,
as you say, I think it's very much Richarlison performs when he's the main man. And last year, as good as Dominic Calvert-Lewin was, there was obviously a huge part of that team missing because Richarlison wasn't on his game. And what Saturday showed was that they can both kind of be the main man in a way that you can get your, I don't know, diving headed goals from Dominic Calvert-Lewin, but you can get your tenacity and work rate and instinctive finishing and all-round play from Richarlison as well. And that needs to be harmonious, really, for us to be successful. I know Rob mentioned that we can't necessarily succeed without Richarlison, but I think we can't necessarily succeed with just having Richarlison as well. And I think it needs to be Richarlison is the main man and wants to be the main man, and Evertonians are more than happy for him to take on that role. But he needs to understand that it's not going to be all reliant on him to a degree. But at the same time, he needs to pull his weight in more ways than one. And that showed on Saturday, which necessarily didn't show last season. I think what I'm trying to get at is, if he wasn't good last season, we weren't good. But what he needs to maybe do is be good in patches of games or in periods of the season as well as someone else.
Yeah.
Being the main man in the team is probably... Premier League sides now don't have a main player. They have five or six, and you look at the likes of City, you look at the likes of Liverpool especially, really, in their, you know, past couple of seasons, they've had probably three or four players that have shared the goals, shared the assists, and shared all the plaudits. And if we want to be building a good side, then Richarlison can be that focal point. He can be that main man, but he needs to be part of a group of players who are at the top of their game, and that's only going to help one another, really. If Richarlison's firing on all cylinders, then he's putting balls in, like the third goal on Saturday. He's running around, breaking up play almost at times, which is crazy from a, you know, Brazilian left forward almost, that you would never really see in the Premier League in years gone by. But he is that all-round entity at Everton. He's the crowd pleaser. He's the grafter, but he's the Brazilian flair, and he's the man that's going to grab you a goal when you need it most. So
yeah,
if he's being run into the ground because we had to maybe keep him happy almost and send him to the Olympics just to have him for that the next season, then so be it. But he's young, he's hungry, and essentially wants to, I imagine, go on to bigger and better things in years to come. And he's got mates like Neymar, he's got mates like these other world superstars, and that's what he wants to be. But it's going to be our benefit for the next couple of seasons, hopefully, because if he does have another season like last season, then the likes of your Barcelonas, the likes of, you know, your big European sides, they probably won't come sniffing because there's young lads coming through. But if he carries on like he did on Saturday, then we'll do very well to hold on to him.
Yeah, and I think that's the context of all of this. And no one wants to think about the best players that you have inevitably exiting, right? I don't think we have to necessarily think that far down the road. I mean, I just sort of acknowledge it more as this is sort of how the sport works. There's always a bigger fish that's going to come after your fish. And I do think that for Richarlison and the club, I think part of the calculus there was he clearly wanted to play in the Olympics. I didn't agree with it, but he really wanted to do it. And I think that the question became for the club and their calculus around this was, you know, we need Richarlison for a variety of reasons to come in for at least this season. Let's not worry about 22, 23, 23, 24, any of that stuff. We can only focus on this season. We need Richarlison to come in, be happy, connected, engaged, what have you. And I think that they made the determination that, look, if Richarlison comes and balls out this season and plays the way he's capable of playing and, quote, earns his move, then Everton don't need to be concerned about whether he's tired next year or the year after. I think Everton are, and even Richarlison has sort of answered this from, and I get that even within a season, players need some rest here and there, whatever. But, you know, I think people need to remember that Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin, these guys are the same age. They're very young. Mm-hmm. They are players who have the capability right now to play a lot of minutes, and so they will. Oh, I'm sorry. There's a helicopter overhead there. Sorry about that. But yeah, like I think that the calculus for Everton is our only concern is that we get the absolute best out of Richarlison this season, because if he plays really well, then Everton have a chance, even though I feel like it's a, you know, kind of an outside chance, but a chance to make it into Europe. And if they do, and Richarlison has played himself into a move, that then means that we will be able to collect, you know, a top price for him later. I think that was probably the thing that shocked Richarlison and the club most about last season. And obviously there's a ton of caveats because of the context of the season, but I think Richarlison sort of thought, based on the talk, that last season was going to be like what we're talking about now. Last season was going to be the season where he scored 25, remember 30 goals was the target Carlo talked about at the time and all this stuff. And I think he got starry-eyed about the end goal without actually, you know, being able to focus on the moment at hand. Richarlison, at least based on the evidence on Saturday, looks like he is fully engaged, fully connected. I think that that's the most important thing. I'm not going to worry about next season. I think we as Evertonians have a problem with that sometimes, of being worried too much about what could happen to a player later or if they're going to stay or what, you know. I'm just focused on this season. This season is all that really matters right now. And we can handle everything else later. But Richarlison playing well, to Adam's point, it can't just be, you know, this whole main man thing. I mean, I don't know that it exists in modern football. And I'll tell you that in for the Brazilian team, he's not the main man, but he finds ways to be. I think what Richarlison needs more than this sort of artificial construct of, quote, being the main man, Richarlison needs to feel involved in the positive outcomes of his side, meaning he needs to be either scoring, assisting, or playing a part. And when he is kind of kicked out onto the perimeter or not engaged or for whatever reason, that's when his those things that you talked about in terms of those kind of behavioral indicators, or just, you know, his shoulders come down a little bit. I still don't think it's cost him much defensively and effort wise, but I do think that he is at his best when he feels like his output is directly tied to the success of the team.
I think generally speaking about Everton's attacking lineup at the weekend, the thing that gave me hope for the season coming forward is that I looked at, do you know what, you can include Townsend a little bit in this, but if you look at Gray, Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison, they are very, very different footballers. There's a lot of different complementary attributes going on there. And I'm reluctant to big his involvement up too much, because as much as I thought he was quietly impressive, the last time I bigged the player up like that was probably Davy Klaassen after his ghost run at home to Stoke City. But I think that having someone like Damari Gray picking up the ball from Alan and picking up the ball from Decore, and primarily meaning that Richarlison doesn't do those things. How many times over the last couple of seasons, countless, have we said, the more Richarlison gets on the football, the worse Everton look, because his build-up play is not necessarily his strength. I don't think it's any coincidence that we saw the best of him in the second half on Saturday. When he comes inside, we let Damari Gray go out wide, and his impact on goal is so much more than he managed in the first half. But Damari Gray, Adam, he's probably not someone on the back of Saturday who's taken all the plaudits necessarily, but he just seemed to fit for me. It just seemed to work very early doors. And I know that you can cut 5 second highlights out of any attack and move and make him look brilliant, but his willingness to receive the ball on the half turn, he's clearly got pace, which we've seen in pre-season, and I think we saw glimpses in the second half when we did go ahead of what he could do on the counter attack out wide on that left hand side. Is he someone who you envisage now, maybe more than when he first signed for us, playing a far greater role than what you ever thought this season?
Yeah, I think in regards to how he's probably been integrated into the side, there's two things that I've not been shocked about, but I've maybe realised a little bit more about Damari Gray. Is pre-season, I thought he was our standout player. I also think that we have been crying out for this pace for a long, long time. And I think it was the post-match, Rob, that you spoke about, is he that rapid, or do we all just look so slow over the past couple of seasons?
Yeah.
And I think it's probably a mixture of both, but at the same time,
I mean, Townsend looks fast compared to what we've had out on the edge over the last few seasons, just to be clear. And Townsend's not slow, mind you. It's just that having wingers, actual wing players play wing as opposed to having number 10s play wing is a big difference.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a mixture of that. And also, he seems to kind of still have this almost like youthful like arrogance and ignorance a little bit, where a player just goes like, what am I good at? I'm just going to do that then.
It's because Everton hasn't ruined him yet, Adam.
That's it. And I think I'm still worried or apprehensive that it may come to the point where it's like Damari Gray is maybe a little bit more of Andros Townsend. I know that's not a slight on Andros Townsend, but he is very much do your job, track back. You can pick out a couple of crosses, but the ball is your easy one inside, or you play a quick one too. And that's, you need those players. But at the same time, we need Damari Gray's Everton, and we need more of them. And you look at the likes of Dwight McNeil or Leon Bailey, who were one that got away and one that may still be happening. But Damari Gray is fitting a mould where if you want to beat teams through something special, and I know a lot of people speak about James Rodriguez in this way, but, and I'm not comparing the both, definitely not, but at the same time, Damari Gray gives Everton something that Everton crave, and that is just pace, directness, and the ability to put the ball in the box early and beat a man. I can't tell you the last time that I watched a game and someone's just beaten the man, whether it's a touch and run, whether it's a quick bit of feet and then you're gone, or whether it's a, like the first half, the quick 1-2 with Seamus Coleman, he's down the line and he's thinking about nothing but finding Dominic Calvert-Lewin's head. And that is a real positive of that recruitment. And then the flip side is that there's no losing in this situation. It costs us £1 million. I doubt he's anywhere near the top, 10 earners at the club. He's on a contract which allows him to feel comfortable and feel part of this project, but at the same time, it's got that slight pressure on that, listen, we've given you a chance to come back to the Premier League. Now's your time to perform. 25 years of age. You've had your good chance at the Premier League that kind of might not have gone the way you wanted to. You've gone out to Germany. You've realised it might not be for you. And now is your time to really come and stamp a mark on this league, because he's got all the ability. He's got that raw pace that cannot be taught. And from looking at him over the past pre-season games and on Saturday, he's technically brilliant as well. And I think with players like that, it's about confidence from your manager, about confidence from your fans and from your club. But it's also about just hitting the ground running. I think he's definitely done that. And yeah, long may it continue, because he can become a real threat for Everton, and he can become, as you said, Mark, someone who fans may not have put at the top of the list of contenders, for player of the season or contenders for someone who's signing of the season. But at the moment, there's not many more to pick from. But at the same time, you'd probably have picked maybe others before him. And then he's definitely putting himself towards the more shrewd but also effective signings in the Premier League this year.
Yeah, he's better on his Xbox than Hammers as well. So stick that on the switch.
Well, Mark, and the other thing I'll mention too, though, about what you guys said, I mean, I think one thing to remember is that he's still so new to the setup, and they didn't have many preseason games. He's still getting kind of used to playing with these guys. He's never played with Richarlison. He probably had, one training session with Richarlison before that game. I mean, very little with Calvert-Lewin. Obviously, not really much in the preseason there either. I think that Damari Gray has the sort of traits that, and as Adam said, given the price tag especially, it's just all upside. He's not coming off an injury. He's incredibly fast. Like, he's not just fast for Everton. he's fast for anyone. And I think that I think that he has an opportunity. And again, I'm not totally sold on the idea that Townsend and Gray should be in your first 11 as your plan A, perhaps. But if there was one of the two, I think that it wouldn't surprise me if he works his way into being in the starting 11 pretty consistently. It's him. And obviously, if we go on to sign no one, it's going to be a lot of Townsend and Gray. And so I've always believed, and again, you don't have to be some mouth breathing Neanderthal about football to think that, to love and understand the quality or the particular qualities that having pace and getting balls into the box can lead to. Yes, maybe you don't build every new bit of your attack around just, crossing into the box, but Everton have been so one-dimensional for so long, even just having this extra dimension, anything that causes the defense a pause, and I've always believed it's going to be speed. And it's going to be a little skill mixed in with that speed that really gets those defenders to think for an extra half second. And sometimes that extra half second is the half second that Calvert-Lewin needs to get the space he needs to score a goal and to be on the end of those deliveries. So I'm excited about Gray, given the context of the bye. And even Townsend at his age, I know he's sort of a stopgap player, but it didn't cost anything. And you can already kind of tell from both Townsend and Gray that they're not going to be net negatives. They're going to probably be neutral to it at the very least. But I think in general, they're going to add something positive because they frankly add a dimension we just haven't had in a while. Yes, you could have a better quality dimension than them, I'm sure. But hey, I'll take what we can get for now and see where we're at the end of the window.
I'd rather have players like Damari Gray and Andros Townsend. And this is, I've just realized how yada this is going to
be. Oh, yeah. This is very Parkhead coming up. I can't wait. I can feel it.
They don't just fit a system, but they fit an ethos as well. And what we have, as Evertonians, been so pent up at over the past couple of years is just players who aren't playing for our club. And it sounds stupid and it sounds Parkhead galore. However, it's true that these players who are here to impress, they are here to get a contract, to get another couple of years, to play for a club that is bigger than them, or it's always going to be bigger than them, but they are lucky to be here. Instead of players who are coming for a retirement home, who are earning huge amounts of money every single week, and they don't necessarily need to impress because the careers are on the way down, or they're probably comfortable and don't need to take that extra step, because no matter what happens, they're going to be fine, whether it's career-wise or whether it's finance-wise. So there's something about Damari Gray and Andros Townsend. You can throw Asmir Begovic in there, and you can these people who are just happy to be at this club, and they want to impress the fans, and they want to do well for us and for themselves. So, yeah, I preferred us when we were skint. I preferred us when we were Everlone or players. And I know it sounds stupid, but that's where a team builds from. And spending money when you're not used to spending money can sometimes bite you in the arse, and it definitely has. And listen, we've got to have both. We've got to have players who are cheap, players who are efficient and shrewd signings, but you've also got to have your superstars and your marquee signings. But you can't have five of them that you spend stupid money on and then not be able to balance a team out. Whereas if we get two, three, four of those who are a little bit cheaper, a bit of an easier option, who are integrating into a system, then you can have your marquee signing, then you can have your big one who comes in and can really impress. So, yeah, it's about a balance, and we have another balance, and I think that Andros Townsend and Damari Gray bring that balance.
Well, Mark, you could also argue, too, that it's I'm not one of these people who wants to go back in time per se. I mean, I do kind of half jokingly understand the going back to it was better when we had no money and Everlone and all of that. I mean, I do think that there's a scenario where you can have the best of both worlds, which is having having that grit and determination along with better resources or better players because you've got the resources. But Adam makes a really good point though, because I don't really care how you want to frame it. If you want to say it's, quote, them playing for the club, the badge, whatever you want to call it. I mean, to me, it's just you need to find players who are motivated for reasons that they can be for a variety of reasons. Like, you may get the best out of Richarlison this season precisely because he wants his move to a, quote, bigger club. And by the way, that's not a slight on Richarlison, who I think cares considerably about Everton. I think he loves the club and he knows how loved he is here, but that his motivation may be that. In the case of Townsend and Gray, these guys, this is for Townsend, this is kind of his last chance probably in the Premier League, given his age and the trajectory of his career per se. For Gray, this is his ultimate crossroads. And so to me, where Everton have made the mistake in terms of squad construction over the last several years is not getting the balance right. You need players who are motivated for varieties of reasons combined with other talented players who are either on the up, quote, who have something to prove for that reason, or simply just high character guys. Like, I think one thing you can say about Townsend is that Townsend comes across as a guy who knows exactly what he is and what he's not, but has committed in both word and deed so far to just giving maximum effort every time. I think that's why the recruitment has to focus. And what's weird is that I feel like in some ways it has, but it's been really hit or miss. It's got to focus on those talented players that you pay the big fees for, being those that are not just talented, but also are the kind of guys that have the sort of pride that they walk out onto the pitch every weekend and say, I'm going to play well because I don't have it in me to not give maximum effort. And people call that character, but that's why, like, I think it's you can look at guys like Luka Dean or Yerry Mina or Ben Godfrey or obviously, Calvert-Lewin, who came in as a kid, but you can look at some of those guys and you can see that they were recruited for certain abilities, but they also had expressed other traits that made you think that, hey, regardless of what you get in terms of output, these guys are not going to dog it. They're not going to half-ass it. But then you have Moise Keane, who had plenty of red flags coming in, and now we see that situation and what it's turned into. And so you need this mix, and getting that mix right is not easy, but you've got to have a mix of high character guys plus a bunch of guys that have motivations that may span the spectrum of motivations. But ultimately, all those motivations need to lead into guys who are all pulling together for one common goal, because they know if they can reach that common goal, then their individual motivations will be satisfied as well.
I think the main positive that I took out of Saturday, and it kind of touches on a little bit of what you both said there, is that it's it's probably the most identifiable Everton performance that I can remember in recent times. It really felt. Yeah. I know there was an enormous amount of emotive things going on with being back at Goodison, etc. But it just really felt like a stereotypically impressive and enjoyable Everton performance. And I think a lot of that has to do with playing wingers, playing with energy, playing that expansive style of football that. I say expansive like some of the world's great sides. So I'm not putting us in that caliber, but Everton at their best, be it under David Moyes or under Rafael Benitez or under Howard Kendall, all had that identifiable, terrifying to play against in a sense of always going to cause you threats from all angles of the field. And I don't necessarily think that we've had that. Clearly. Carlo Ancelotti had a way of doing things, and there was an element of pragmatism about it. There was an element of, you know, this guy knows how to win things, and winning things is everything. And as much as that obviously still is the case, there seemed to be a freedom about how we played and about how the players did enjoy, you know, people like Abdoulaye Doucouré going forward and talking before the game about how he wants to be the actual footballer that he is. And not someone who's been constrained by his manager to play a certain way to get an extra 0.5% out of him so that we might eventually go one further round in the League Cup. It's not necessarily about that. It's about letting players like that unleash themselves. And I think, I mean, how many times have you watched that Abdoulaye Doucouré goal? I don't even watch Everton highlights, really. I don't necessarily ever watch Match of the Day, even when we win. I have watched that goal more times than I can even remember now, because it's what Everton playing at Goodison Park is. That everything about that goal, it's not necessarily a brilliant build-up, but it feels as though it's grown on a bed of energy to that moment whereby he just puts every element of effort that he's got into that swinging right foot. Mm-hmm. You could see it from the reaction in the stands as well. I can't remember a time where we've celebrated a goal like that, that on the grand scale of the season will probably seem a little bit meaningless in 30 games time. But the energy that was there, and some of the characteristics that you talk about certain players there, sometimes you watch a footballer come to Goodison Park and play a couple of games for Everton, and you very quickly know that he just gets it. And it's something that you can't necessarily put your finger on. And I am sure that fans of other football clubs think this about their signings as well. But Rob, you mentioned one in terms of Ben Godfrey, who, and I think that the word you used was character. But all you have to do, be it watching on the TV or watching in the stadium, is take one look at that lad when he's in the midst of that 90 minutes and you just know that it's his everything. And every footballer will tell you that rhetoric anyway, but it's not always the case when you go out and sign, yes, players of higher quality, but you're not necessarily getting that know-how about how to be a professional sportsman. And that's really belittling, I know, to some of the players that we've signed in recent times, but someone like Ben Godfrey will go far further than other players that have played for this club, because
that's why James Rodriguez is on his way out, because look, there is always, in the beautiful game, whatever you want to call it, there's always going to be room and a big lens on the dudes that can make magical things happen. And I do genuinely mourn for the idea. I mourn for James Rodriguez's career at Everton not being a little longer so fans could see him, all those caveats, because I think he's such a beautiful player to watch. But I think that those types of players you're describing fit better when they are added to a team that already has established foundational principles of consistency of effort and output and all those sorts of things, right? I think that that's where Everton have really messed up in terms of some of the signings they've made. They've tried to. I mean, it's not a terrible idea on the surface to say we want to sign a bunch of skilled guys because you have more skilled side, you'll win more. And I mean, I get that. But I think that Everton didn't have, again, going back to that idea of the mix, They didn't have, I mean, look, Everton has suffered from, you know, one thing they didn't suffer from under Moyes was having kind of a core collective ethos or group of players who all sort of established expectation levels of what, as you guys put it, playing at Goodison and playing for these fans means. And you're right, it's not just an Everton thing, but, you know, we're only talking about Everton here. And so I think that what we're also talking about and not talking about all at the same time is that this squad has had a severe leadership deficiency over the last half decade or so. And when I say leadership, it's not all just about the captain not being, you know, that great or whatever, and in this all being on Seamus Coleman or Phil Jagielka or whatever. It has been about the fact that for whatever reason, you've not had enough players feel empowered enough to, you know, to step up and lead, you know, as a group or collectively or get on the same page. Maybe there have been too many factions between maybe some of the international players versus some of the English players. What I mean, who knows? I don't want to speculate too much on that. But what I do think is that if you have got a core group that have learned to play together in a way that is at times very kind of unsexy and unnuanced, but yet is full of effort and full of guile and full of scrappy wins and so on and so forth. That's how you sort of begin to build a foundation that allows you to then add those more nuanced, skilled players to that mix. And I just don't think that – I think Everton tried to essentially – add those players in before it's sort of like they tried to install the 75-inch big screen before the walls on the house had even been built yet. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's been consistently the issue there. And hopefully that's something that can change and really will come down to not only the players who are still here, because we can't replace all of these players, but it'll be about a manager too. And Benitez is going to have to play a role in this as well. Mm-hmm. He can't do everything on his own. He has to find ways, because part of being manager isn't just picking the lineup or deciding on a formation. It is about pressing buttons from a personality perspective and from a management perspective to try to empower and enable your players to be more accountable and to, you know, and, you know, to kind of exert some of that authority on the side. I think it's unfair to expect that Seamus Coleman, for instance, on his own has to carry the entire load of being the leader because he is going to fail, because no one person can do that effectively. Like, as much as you can point to every great captain in the history of this league, they all have, you know, they all happen to be great captains because they also played with other players who had a lot of character and who performed really well. And I think, and to, you know, Everton have to find some base level of consistency before they can start getting cute with it, which I think that's been part of the underlying issues for seasons running now.
Yeah, absolutely. Nevertheless, really, really positive start from Rafael Benitez.
Hey, Mark, you were going to mention the player that maybe didn't benefit from the crowd. I don't want to just skip past that.
On the topic of absolute micro analysis after one game of the season, the player who is always thrown into this mix, Rob, is Michael Keane. He's someone who I think most of us would kind of coin him as a confidence centre-half, which is quite a dangerous calibre to be in. If you could have shown me any player leading up to Saturday that would probably take a bit of a heavy touch or hesitate a little bit longer than he would have done over the last 12 months, he probably would have been the guy I go to. And I know this is incredibly micro-analysis because we saw Mason Holgate do this when there was absolutely no fans there. You know, these things do happen, in particular to centre-halves. And at this level, they will be punished, especially if your team have just signed an up-and-coming striker. He will score that one-on-one. But yeah, Adam, do you read too much into that with Keane? I know a lot of people have kind of looked at that game beyond that moment and, you know, the two centre-backs switching over and, you know, was this an error that was originally at the start of the game that we fixed, or was it an impulsive move from Benitez? are we reading into this far too much, or is Michael Keane someone who we do have to keep an eye on in terms of how he adapts to the return of fans to football?
I just think we need to probably keep an eye on any of our central defensive partnerships or players. And I think, as you say, there's always going to be that element of being a defender that, and a goalkeeper even more so, that if you make a mistake, then it's going to end up in a goal, or it's going to end up in someone that I'm getting sent off, or it's going to have a huge impact on that period of the game and that game in full, really. So, yeah, I think Michael Keane has done so well to drag himself back into the positive mindset and the almost, you could say that Everton fans had a different impression of him years ago, but has very much changed that with just being Michael Keane and doing what Michael Keane was always good at. And I think it's probably two things, really. It's Michael Keane making a mistake, which happens, and it's also Rafael Benitez finding out about what his best defensive partnership is, whereabouts on which side those defenders play. He did it with the lads on the wing as well, and with Charleston. And it's just slight tweaks that you're going to have to find out about playing a competitive match in the Premier League. You can do all the tactics and the chopping and changing you want on the training pitch, or you can do it in pre-season games. But there's nothing else that you can really figure out until you're fully in that campaign of the Premier League. So, yeah, I think it's probably just us getting back to, or Everton getting back to that, you know, huge roar of emotion, or that on a knife edge almost of atmosphere, that you can find yourself in a bit of a lapse of concentration. And once the crowd maybe did die down after that first 20 minutes, then it's always going to be a case of who can keep the heads and who can really stay fixated on the task at hand. So, yeah, I don't want to look too much into it. I don't think that Michael Keane or Mason Holgate are starters at centre-half for Everton moving forward.
Yeah,
I think it's having an option of those two being able to come in as and when needed and make a good impact on the game. And then if I'm probably ordering those four, 1-4, I'd probably have Mason Holgate fourth, Michael Keane third, Yerry Mina second, and Ben Godfrey at the top of that. And I think that's just based on pure and simple performance and consistency last year. So I thought Mason Holgate and Ben Godfrey were the way forward. As soon as Ben Godfrey came in, I thought they're both young, they're fast, they love a physical battle, they're good footballers and they can play. But the more and more I see Mason Holgate, more than Michael Keane, the more and more it worries me that rash element of just, and again, not to sound like a dar, it's just, it's there's something about Mason Holgate that he's not Ben Godfrey. And I think that's probably the biggest criticism you can give to him. And he's got all of the ability you can have to be Ben Godfrey. He's just not maturing like Ben Godfrey has, and over a very much quicker period of time.
Well, that comparison you've just made, that's essentially what leads us to conversations like this, because the brutal nature of having strength in depth in one particular area of the field means that heavy touch that Michael Keane takes is the difference between us going into that game at Elland Road at the weekend thinking, well, why change something that isn't broke? We've got a winning setup. Let's go with it. And the more and more you watch that goal back, and I get it, it's a very isolated moment, but you are automatically looking at Ben Godfrey and thinking, well, how do we get this lad back into the starting 11? And that is unfortunately just the nature of competition. But Rob, what do you make of it?
I mean, I brought us back to this point because I want to reiterate a little of what I said on the post-match, which is, when you're talking about a Premier League season, you're going to need, it's really more about, as much as everyone focuses on this idea of, well, you've just got to find this one partnership and that's all it's ever going to be and blah, 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 where I think it's a little more nuanced, and that I really think it's about having three solid, reliable, somewhat interchangeable center halves. Yeah. Because whether it's injury, whether it's a matchup oriented decision, what have you, you need to have at least three guys that you can really count on. Take away the mistake that Michael Keane made. And by the way, I think I've said it last season as the season went on. Well, I mean, he didn't play very well in the second half of the season, but I thought Michael Keane and Yerry Mina actually as a partnership played incredibly well for the first half of the season. They were not the problem. And in fact, I think they were very, very good. They dominate in the air. They do a lot of good things. But even if Michael Keane had not made the mistake, and by the way, I think Mason Holgate didn't really cover himself in glory on it at that moment either, because yes, Keane turned it over, but I don't know what that clearance attempt that Holgate tried to make, but they just Armstrong just breezed past him. It was weird. But I think that even without that mistake, you could take that mistake away, and it's not about that. I still would have said to you after that game with the same result, hey, that's great, we won that, but Ben Godfrey and Yerry Mina are our two best center halves, and I think that they complement one another best as well, because I do believe maybe getting sucked back into that whole Zuma-Keen vortex of the past, that the idea of having a really, you know, a big, tall guy who can dominate in the air combined with a recovery defender with really good pace, that appeals to me quite a bit as a good complementary team. Tandem, and I've seen that when Yerry Mina and Godfrey have played together. I want to see them play together more. It's ironic that we're playing Leeds this weekend away, which that was also one of the performances where Godfrey and Mina played together last season and I thought played really well. But the bottom line is that I think Keane is still solidly our third best center half. He needs to be good. He needs his confidence. He needs whatever it is, because that's kind of where we're at right now. Where I take issue with what Adam said is probably just in the notion that I don't think Mason Holgate has the same traits as Ben Godfrey. I think that Mason Holgate is a smallish defender, or smallish central defender, let me clarify. And that's okay if you make up for it with blazing pace, for instance, or incredible skill with the ball. But he doesn't really have those things, you know? I mean, I think that's the thing is Godfrey is the same height as Holgate. And by the way, I'm not really thrilled with the idea of playing 2 6-foot, and that's generous central defenders. I think Godfrey is solidly 6 feet, but I think Mason Holgate is probably closer to 5'11". But I think I want at least one dude back there who's 6'3", 4", 5", or above, right? Like, I want that guy back there. But what Mason Holgate lacks for me is, I feel like there's a lack of maturity there that doesn't get talked about nearly enough. I think he makes some rash tackles out there. I think he thinks he's a lot better than he actually is. He's not as fast as Godfrey. He's not as physical as Godfrey. He's not as large as Godfrey. Godfrey is literally faster, stronger, and bigger than Mason Holgate. So other than that, they're exactly the same, right? But I just don't buy that they are. I think that what maybe to Adam's point, they are classed as the same kind of maybe more mobile version of a center half. And I can kind of say that about Holgate. Holgate's the idea of Holgate is that he's a little more fluid. He's a guy that is not going to get beat for pace too often. I just think he makes too many mental mistakes, and he doesn't have the pace that Godfrey does to recover from said mistakes at times. And I think that that's where the issue is. But ultimately, I think that what we don't want to do is go through the same repeated cycle again of trying to figure out who these, you know, three rotational guys are. It felt like Carlo Ancelotti he'd found a mix that worked. And then as soon as Luka Dean came back from injury, he didn't really know what to do. And it suddenly became this chop and change every week, you know, in the back line. So I think what Rafa has to do ultimately is find a way to establish not only a partnership that work, but really two partnerships that work amongst three guys. I think that's the stability that you ultimately look for. When you're playing in Europe, then you have to have more than that. But I almost think Everton having 4 or even 5, if you want to count Branthwaite, having 5 center half choices almost makes it the job harder, because it's almost like they're paralyzed by the options that they have, because there isn't one guy that stands head and shoulders above all of them. As good as Godfrey is, he's really good. he's still a kid basically, right? So I want to give him the grace to still grow, still make some mistakes, what have you. But I've seen enough of Mason Holgate. I'd love for us to move him on. I don't think we'll be able to anytime soon, but I've made my stance known on that for a while. Give me Keane, Mina, and Godfrey in some combination of those three as your primary options going forward.
Certainly interesting to see if Everton, you know, on the back of FFP desperation, which is now suddenly a thing, whether we do token that centre-half position as overkill. Possibly, and you do possibly look to move someone like Mason Holgate on. I think whilst we're talking about squad strength, we cannot go any further without saying how poor Southampton are. It's always refreshing in the opening weeks of a Premier League season to take one big, huge look around on the back of a victory and point the finger at the teams that you think will struggle. They were absolutely one on Saturday. I think that there's only so long that you can go with this model of consistently selling good players before you realise that you don't have a great deal left. Give James Ward-Prowse the ball. He is capable of causing issues, but I think beyond that, they really struggled. I thought Arsenal were another team at the weekend. I don't know if anyone saw that opening Premier League game at Brentford, but They look like a team that just have nothing to offer. In the closing days of the transfer window, that may change, but I don't necessarily see how them going out and signing a £24 million goalkeeper to rival Bernd Leno is going to do a great deal for their fortunes, but we'll see. And it's nice to be on this pedestal to look around, but I obviously mentioned the transfer window briefly then, guys. Yes, we have three very close-knit away games coming up, but obviously in the next, 13 days, we are going to see a hellish 13. Transfer window for Everton. And by that, I mean, I think the chaos levels were already quite high on the back of major tournaments this summer, but it does feel as though the 13 remaining days of the transfer window are going to very quickly become three without much really changing. And then Everton will be one of the most proactive clubs in the last few days of the window. You were the man.
Do you really think that?
Well, this is obviously going to be from an outgoing potential because if the rumours are to be believed, we've obviously got potentially players like Mason Holgate on the list, which has been developed by Rafael Benitez and Marcel Brands as acceptable losses in the squad department. But Moise Keane,
I think we've got about three players who are not on the list, right? Like, I think if there was a good offer that came in for even players that I like, hey, Mark, I've said on this show before, if someone came in with a big offer for Yerry Mina, I love Yerry Mina, he's my favorite player, but like, we're not really in a position to say no on certain things, right? Like, I think barring Richarlison, Calvert-Lewin, and Godfrey, and Jordan Pickford for this season, I think at the very least, like, okay, so that's where I was curious. And Adam, I want your thoughts too. Like, I don't know. I don't have anything to go off of other than this idea that, well, we're going to get down to 72 hours or 48 hours left, and then things will just happen because that's what has to happen. There's no indications right now that we have players that are even heavily linked with being outgoings. And from everything we've read, if there aren't outgoings, we can't spend money. And if we can't spend money, then what do we, I think the best we could hope for is we create some really creative loan with an obligation to buy sort of deal laid on for a player that we might want, but I don't know what you're going to get for that either. And so I'm trying to have a little faith here, but I get the sense, and we won't be able to know until after the window closes, that so much of this seemed to hedge on selling Moise Keane, and then Keane found a way to just crater his own value. Like, again, we said it before, what other club would have a player go out on loan to PSG, score a boatload of goals, and then still not be able to sell him? It feels very only Everton, and I don't know why, but Moise Keane just kind of making a fuss about how he only wanted to go back to PSG, I think has really killed his market. And then we're just kind of stuck holding the bag. That's what I'm worried about. I'm worried that, like, Moise Keane is a player whose talent I still believe in, but I'm just not sure I believe in his career, given how he seems to respond to basic adversity or challenges. And if he's, quote, stuck at Everton for another season, you would think the reaction would be that he's going to play his balls off to get his move. But I'm not really sure that Moise Keane has that Richarlison gene to be able to do something like that.
I'd also say I'm just resigned to the fact that we will maybe get a couple more loans and cheap signings in. I know I said before I preferred us when we were skint, but
ever loan, yeah.
I'd also want us to at least bring in a player that we all then go, right, we've got a good chance of having a go at this here in regards to trying to find ourselves in a European position come the end of the season. So
would that be an attacking player, Rob?
No, I think that needs to be a player that fits our system, whether it's a right back, whether it's a central midfielder, whether it is, a left-sided right forward or someone who's going to, bring another element of that from five almost. And I know it sounds stupid.
We attack fullback. We use fullbacks to attack in theory, right? So,
the modern-day attackers, aren't they, really? And I think we've been so nullified on that right-hand side over the past couple of seasons. And we talk about Seamus Coleman, he's brilliant and he's the perfect captain and he's a fantastic servant. But we need someone who's going to actually fit into this system going forward. And you can play all the wingers you want. And if you have a left-back and a right-back bombing on past them, it's going to give you even more of a threat, even more of a dimension to change things up and have maybe a left-footed right forward who can cut in and have someone creating space on his right-hand side. And I think we need someone. And the right-back doesn't necessarily have to be the big money signing. It can be, there's a few names I've heard thrown around. The fella Buter, is it, or Buter? And if I don't know much about, I don't know anything about him. And maybe that's sometimes the excitement that you get if it is someone you've never really heard of, if it is someone that isn't a huge amount of money, then maybe it is an option for the likes of Marcel Brands to really start making an impact. And his success, Marcel Brands, for me, has come in those defensive areas, but bringing in young lads who are on the way up in their career and signing them for very little, if any, money. I'm just worried that it will get to the point where we have our hands tied so much that we will have to bring in a couple of loan players who aren't necessarily going to take us forward in the long run. And that, or we may fall victim to having to let someone bigger than we realise go. Whether that is Moise Keane, who for me, he doesn't have a future at Everton. And as Rob says, he's very much pushed himself into a corner in the fact that he said, I want to go to PSG, and they've gone and signed Lionel Messi, and I don't think you're probably going to get in the side ahead of him. And therefore, we've got to look elsewhere and offloading the likes of Yerry Mina or James Rodriguez. How much money are you going to get for James Rodriguez? Does that ease our pain enough for us to bring in 2, 3, 4 players? So it's a real tough period for those making the decisions at Everton, and one that I'm not jealous of, I'm definitely wanting them to make the right ones, because we've had this many, many times where it's a fine line between panicking but also doing your business in the right way. And then if it comes to those final hours, I know we're going to see Vinnie O'Connor, whoever it is, stood at Finch Farm for 37 hours on the final day of the transfer window talking about, Ryan Bertrand or whoever some rubbish right. Well, he's a left back. Right back from the Premier League who is surplus to requirements, and then we'll go and sign some mad player for next to no fee that we've never heard of, who we hope can make an impact. And is it exciting? Is it stressful? It's probably a little bit of both. Am I here for it?
Yeah. Well, and by the way, I'd add to that too, that maybe this is just the expectations game and I'm sort of internally managing my future disappointment or what have you. But look, when we all thought, and let's also be honest, we've thought for about what, three summers now, that we were going to go finally identify the Luka Dean on the right-hand side that has just never come to fruition. With 13 days left in the window, I've now shifted very much mentally from we need to sign the future right back here to, well, we need to have decent coverage, because regardless of how you feel about Seamus Coleman at this point, can you imagine Liverpool saying that their plan for the season was to start Milner, 30 something games in the league? No, everyone would laugh and say it's absurd. And I would even argue that, I'll use Milner as an example, right? Part of his effectiveness at that club has been that he has not had to be a full-time starter. His value has been that he could be the spot starter. He could be the guy that came on late on to provide a burst of energy, or to provide, someone that you could rely on in those final few minutes or what have you. That's the role that I think Seamus Coleman, who, by the way, played fine. And he played well on Saturday. It's not that Seamus Coleman isn't capable of having a good game. It's just simply how long can you continue to roll the dice with a player who is aging, who we saw last season missed a lot of time with injury, missed a considerable amount of time with injuries. I mean, that's not an indictment on Coleman. And I even hate that I even have to fucking keep saying it, because I feel like I'm the Coleman hater. No, I hate the situation. I don't hate Seamus Coleman. I hate that Everton have found a way to not address such a glaring need for so many seasons in a row. And so now, with 13 days left, I've now shifted into, we need a body there. We need, granted, unless you think Jonjo Kenny is a reasonable facsimile of a deputy at that position, which I frankly just don't. I think I've seen enough of Jonjo Kenny to not think he is. I just want some decent coverage there. And I guess in theory, we revisit this topic again next summer, which we'll probably not sign anyone else. And then we'll extend Seamus Coleman's contract again and just kick the can down the road some more.
All we're hoping is that Seamus Coleman has an absolute shocker on Saturday. Therefore, we are forced into signing a right back instead of making do for another season. Seamus Coleman will be 75 and on the team sheet for Everton.
It's always really interesting. It's funny you mention that you get to the end of August and the end of January, and the correlation between how a team performs within the space of two games in 6 days and their last ditch activity in the transfer window always fascinates me. It reeks of a club with no long-term plan. And I think from that sense, what I don't want to see happen in the next few days is for Everton to make it 4 wins out of 4, get to what the last game be. It'll be the Brighton game away from home. And you see Marcel Brands and Rafael Benitez kick their feet up and think everything will be sound here. And I'm sure it's not as naive as what I suggest there, but it is always interesting to see those clubs who go crashing out of the League Cup early doors, lose their second straight league game on the bounce, and then impulsively lash £75 million at their problems. But I think what we're saying there in terms of putting a few results together, that is, in essence, the difference between having a capable team and a resolute squad. What an Everton at the moment, for me, should be capable of beating a poor Southampton team at home. Leeds will be a tough game. You probably go there every year and you say, if we play relatively well and get a point, that's not the end of the world. I want to see us comfortably go through against Huddersfield, and I want to see us go down to Brighton and beat them, because that's the type of game that previous on the cusp of greatness Everton teams have never been able to pull off. Going away to Bournemouth, as we mentioned earlier, Brighton, going up to Newcastle, wherever it may be, all those teams who are mid to low level Premier League sides, and just dispatching them with ease. And I get it, you can't do that every week, because if you do, you win the whole thing. But that's the difference between having that level of caliber about your squad, or burning someone like Richarlison into every single minute of his available exercise potential, which is probably going to happen this season because he absolutely lives for it. But Yeah, it was interesting to see Rob go through the stages of Everton and finally hit an acceptance in terms of where the pursuit of a right back is. But I don't know, Rob, so much of the, frustratingly for me, I think so much of the ideal signing that we mentioned, and you know, that one key signing that makes you think you've got that challenge in you, like Adam said, that was Denzel Dumfries for me. He was the one that ticked all of these boxes. If he was in that squad right now, I'd feel so relaxed about how we go into this back into the window.
Well, and that's the thing is, it's not like Denzel Dumfries is some like, I don't even know that he's world class necessarily or anything like that, but I mean, we literally have a song about how little we paid for Seamus Coleman and how proud we are of the fact that we paid very little to get what has turned out to be a very good, solid to very good career out of a guy we paid $60,000 for. That's Denzel Dumfries to me was the obvious play. Now, again, you'll get the revisionist history of, well, we were never really after him or whatever, you know, who knows? I don't know. But you know, you asked the question before when right back was mentioned, do we need an attacking player? To me, that those fullback positions are attacking positions now. And yes, I do like the, I would, let me put it this way. If I had Denzel Dumfries, or someone of a relatively high attacking caliber at that position, I feel a lot better about having to roll with Andros Townsend and Damari Gray for a little bit more, because you've at least got that attacking impetus that balances out what Luka Dean does on the left-hand side, right? I mean, the irony of all of this is that we're going to finally sign a pretty decent caliber attacking right back right at the point where Luka Dean's play starts to, you know, tail off a little bit, or right before he gets sold or something like that. I mean, I think it's just sad that, and I've said this before, that Everton's inability, it's not even about ambition. I mean, everyone criticizes Everton for spending all this money and blah, blah, blah. I don't mind Everton having taken shots over the last few years, trying to make it. You got to take some home run swings. I got no problem with that. But their inability to address just basic needs get me an above average right back who can potentially be better than above average. That's not asking a lot. I'm not asking us to go out and pay $50 million for, you know, like whatever City paid for, you know, any of the fullbacks they've bought over the last several seasons. Like, I'm just asking for us to address basic things. And to me, it's not even a question of ambition. It's just about basic competency. And that's what's sad to me, because I was sold on the idea that Marcel Brands would bring competency to this thing. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't want to put all this on Marcel Brands, because as we know, no one, or as we don't know, I guess is the better way to say it, no one really knows what he is empowered to do and not do at the club. And so we kind of pick and choose who we think are Marcel Brands players, but regardless of whose fault it is, we just have not competently addressed a glaring hole that has been a glaring hole for at least 3 years now. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it. And I think we're going to be looking at a Jibril Sidibe type of stopgap again for one more season, and then we go again. And it's just, to me, the saddest part about it is it's just an opportunity missed.
Yeah. Well, Matteo Ferrari still available from what I've heard. So up the slightly above average Sofies, but guys, we'll leave it there. I don't want to go too much into the previews of all of the games that are coming up, because the next time that we get together for Kickabout, Rob, we'll have had Leeds and Huddersfield. We've got so much coming up on the show this week. Obviously, previews to both of those games. Subs Weekly is out already. Rob, you joined Matt and Mike on that. Loads of fallout from what was an unbelievable day at Goodison Park at the weekend. But if you want to catch any of us, Twitter, DMs are always open. If you want to catch Adam, he'll be under the Play For Your Club banner in PE2 in the Park End. He's always always happy to have chats about James Rodriguez, and particularly pointing to the crest, you'll see him, heart on the sleeve sort of conversation. Always offer that sort of stuff.
Or power washing. He'll always talk power washing with you as well.
Power washing's definitely up there.
We're still open to sponsors, by the way. So
yeah. Karcher, if you are listening, we are still available. But yeah, for Rob, Adam, and myself, that's been your Kickabout. Join us again soon on the Blue Room.
Confessions from Pitch and Forge.
You might not believe this. I can't get enough of those shows and dinner theaters. Country Tonight, Murder Mystery, Pirates, Stampede. That's where you'll find me.
Hey guys, back from Pigeon Forge. My brother is still annoying, but my parents get an A+, cool places to stay, insta-worthy food, and the island was really fun.
Confessions from Pigeon Forge. Visit mypigeonforge.com to plan your trip today.
Sports Social Podcast Network.